Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, and sitting across from me is...
Mike Cosentino. I'm going to pronounce my name correctly today.
Cosentino.
That's right. Well, we're aware of ethnic names today.
Yeah, and how did it get started being pronounced Cosentino?
Because it was more common. Constantino, there was a lot of those around. Bill Cosby, I hate to make that comparison, But my dad wanted to be more American, and Cosentino was more American.
We're going to be interviewing via the magic of the telephone with a candidate for U.S. Senate in Arizona in the Democratic Party. There are two candidates, if I understand it.
Yeah, one's on TV 24/7, and we're going to talk to Deidre Abood today. Good morning, Deidre.
Good morning.
So, as Mike just mentioned, I mean, right from the start, you're running against a candidate who is on television 24/7, who's raised millions of dollars, who we've interviewed several times in the past, extremely talented politician, and you're running against her in the Democratic primary, which we think is great that we have at least a Democratic primary going.
Exactly, and we promise we're going to give you a chance to talk sometime in the next 44 minutes.
Well, maybe,
but I want to jump on this. I have to admit, Kyrsten Sinema's, her ads just make me want to punch the TV. And I don't know why. I don't have a rational explanation for that. But
you're a violent guy.
I guess. That must be it. So, anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Deidre. So now that we're having some fun, but go ahead and tell us about why you're running for the U.S. Senate. Tell us, tell folks out here who you are, and that's about it. The start of it.
Well, I'm originally from Arkansas, so you'll hear the accent come out as we go, and I moved to Arizona in 98. Well, I mean, in Arkansas, I was the youngest of four girls raised by a single parent. And, you know, during that time, I went to public school. I played sports. I attempted college. But, you know, it was expensive having to work two jobs in order to pay to go to college. So in 98, my mom actually came out here in Arizona for a conference, and I had some vacation time that I was going to lose if I didn't use it, so I came out here with her on vacation and fell in love with the state, decided that this is absolutely where I wanted to live. So I went back to Arkansas and basically set a date, gave a 3-month notice to my employer, packed my bags, and drove across country where I did not know one person, didn't have a job, and didn't have a place to live, and figured those things out in 98, and then I became a civil rights and social justice activist. Then I went to law school. There's a cool story about that. It involves Arpaio's people actually motivating me to go to law school. That story's actually on YouTube because our campaign's on YouTube. And then in 2016, I became really frustrated. You know, number one, so many of our elected leaders weren't having town halls. They weren't explaining to us, you know, how they were voting, why they were voting. And they also weren't showing leadership in that there were people campaigning on all levels that were disparaging marginalized groups for nothing but political gain. And if that wasn't bad enough, the other colleagues weren't holding them accountable. These are elected officials that are there to show leadership, to make things make sense. And they were just checked out. So I decided that I wanted to do something, and I wanted to do something to change the expectation of this office. I wanted, as a U.S. senator, we should expect that our U.S. senators, as well as all of our elected leaders, have town halls, are willing to meet the people, explain what's going on, explain why they're voting for things and how they're voting. What's the thought process? You should be able to face your constituency. And I wanted to raise the expectation that we should expect people who are in elected office to visit the areas that they represent. So, you
that's
know,
been a terrible problem up here in northern Arizona, where we often see whether you're Republican or a Democrat as an afterthought to Maricopa County, which is
right.
where the vast majority of the population lives. But still, no one likes being an afterthought. And I've worked with Republicans, and they've complained about being mistreated by their state party. So I think it's very important what you're talking about. We have a whole series of candidates who will never appear in a forum on the state level. We never see any of them. They talk only to groups of their party, particularly Republicans. They don't want to get in any kind of debate. They don't want to do anything that will open up the campaign to one of your themes is, which is transparency.
Yeah, we are very transparent. We have the most detailed website of anybody in the race because people deserve to know where you stand on issues and why you stand there. And you should be able to not only put it on your website, but you should be able to stand before people and defend your position, express your position. That's what communication is, and that's what leadership is, and that's what we elect you for. And all of our events are public. Every event we go to is on our website, on our Facebook, because we want every single person who would like to come and hear what we have to say and listen to us answer questions, which is another problem. Often we have elected leaders come in and give a speech and they're gone.
Deidre, a question for you, sort of a quick technical question here. Are you on speakerphone or talking directly in?
Directly in.
Okay. We're picking up some background sounds. A mysterious the owner of the station has thrown his hands up into the air, and he's screaming quietly. So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're trying to make sure we've got the best connection for you so people can hear you as
We're talking to Deidre Abood, candidate for U.S. Senate in Arizona, in our district. We want to talk about it. Now, Deidre presents certainly a different visual for folks. We're on the radio here, but she wears some traditional Muslim outfit, at least. You want to describe that a little bit, Deidre, so I don't screw it up completely?
Basically, I dress modestly, and in my interpretation of modesty, and I wear a scarf on my head, which is my interpretation of how I want to represent myself. And yes, I'm Muslim. I'm also, an American that grew up in America with a very romantic relationship with the Constitution. And one of my platform issues is separation of religion and state, because no one has religious liberty unless everybody has religious liberty, including people who don't want religion. And I'm, tell you a secret, I happen to be religious. I believe in religion for me. But I don't believe that my government should ever interfere or interpret people's relationship with a higher power or at all.
What kind of responses are you getting, Deidre? Just that. I'm imagining the worst. And certainly I know a few things, but I'm imagining the worst. You have a Muslim woman campaigning in Arizona for U.S. Senate. Tell us what that's like.
Actually, it's been great. I mean, I expected much more negative responses, and it hasn't been the case. I think people are reasonable. I think people, if you're willing to reach out and connect with them, they're willing to reach out and connect back with you. I don't just go to Democratic events.
Uh-huh.
I go to any event where there's people. I mean, we even go to raves. We were the first candidate to ever go to raves in Arizona, and I've been to four. And the reception has been great because people actually want to talk about issues. They don't, all of this other stuff is just a distraction. The worst things that have happened is, number one, online, that there can be a lot of negativity on Facebook yep. and on other social media. But, I'm not special in that. Everybody gets that. Even if I wasn't running for office, I would get that.
The bullies are brave online, for sure.
I saw a website out there that's kind of anti-Muslim hate group. At least that's what it looks like to me. I only got a brief look at it, and your name came up.
Oh, my.
There's a whole industry. I mean, there's big money in spreading hate, whether it's Muslims or against blacks or against Latinos or against even Native Americans. I mean, it is not just a, you know, normal people who hate. There's a financial gain from spreading this.
Yeah.
It's an industry. There's many documentaries on it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the... So you're not encountering personally, when you go and talk to people, with much negative feedback about being a Muslim, right?
No, I mean, sometimes people do have questions, which I'm perfectly open to. And we've had 4 incidents of white supremacists, and, you know, we stood up to them and showed them that I'm perfectly willing to respect their freedom of speech, but I'm also not going to be intimidated by them, because my mom worked the Timothy McVeigh case, so I grew up knowing that white supremacists existed. I grew up knowing what they thought. I grew up knowing that they were a fringe element, and in 2016, they gained the same status in the marketplace of ideas of anybody else, and that's shocking to me, and we have to stand up against that. I can do it respectfully, but I can do it with strength.
The fish rots from the head back, is the ancient Okie saying, I guess, about other places. All right, so you're not having too much of a negative response to being a Muslim, and you're actually able to get people to listen to your platform.
Right, in all age groups, but particularly the young people, millennial and below, they are particularly energized, because they want people who stand for something. And even the older generations, I believe that people want to believe you. They're okay with disagreeing with you, but they want to know what you stand for, and they want to believe that you actually stand for it, which is another reason why I think it's so important that our website has the most detail.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think old and young, they'll want a person of faith is better than not. At least going into some of the electorate, you know, and that you have this certainly strength of character that comes through in all of your speeches. Tell us a little bit about you did. I think you were particularly effective when you were in Sedona yesterday. You come to Sedona often. You come to the Verde Valley. You've spoken in Cottonwood. You've spoken in Sedona. You've spoken all around the area. So I do want to let folks know that are listening that you will have a chance before this is all over to meet and chat with Deidre Abood as she runs for U.S. Senate. But tell us characterize your experience with your speaking engagement yesterday.
Well, my job is to let people get to know me and see where I stand on issues, and then also to excite them, to motivate them, to inspire them. And that's really what this year is all about. I mean, people are hungry for people who want their vote, and their vote is priceless. They're hungry for people to inspire them. They're hungry for people not to just be the same thing and the same boring speeches and the same talking points. And that's really exciting about this year. I mean, we had so many candidates there yesterday, and so many of them really brought that energy and that power and that excitement to the crowd. And that's what we're seeing in 2018, is we have so many people running for office who are not career politicians, who are not just talking about the same tired talking points that everybody's heard that doesn't mean anything. They're actually talking about the issues that matter, and they actually want to make change. And they are people who normally would not go into politics because everybody thinks politics is dirty, but they've decided that maybe if we got some people into politics who actually were there for the right reasons, that we could actually make a change.
I agree wholeheartedly that we have a whole crop of very exciting and not your normal Kelly Fire running for governor, and so on. Deidre Abood running for Senate. This is an exciting time. And as you say, I think it's energizing that for young people to see you running for such a high office. And it's inspiring. But when I talk to the the old guard politicos in Arizona. You know, they look at Deidre Boo, they look at Kelly Fryer, and they shake their head. Now, I'm sure they did the same thing with Donald Trump. So that makes, for good or for ill, the Trump phenomena, has changed all the rules. But I think the old guard doesn't believe that. They will shake their head and say, you know, it's not going to happen. How are you going to make it happen?
We're going to make it happen because, like I said, we're raising the expectation of this office. We're giving people permission to expect more from this office, to expect that their elected leaders are going to visit 15 counties in 6 years, at least once, that people are going to hold their elected leaders accountable. I'm giving them permission to hold their elected leaders accountable that we live in the state of Arizona, not the state of Maricopa.
Yeah. Amen.
I have a question for you, and it's kind of general, but what do you think are your – I see you have a broad platform. What do you think are the most important leading issues to address in your race for the U.S. Senate? What are the most important issues? What are you getting the most feedback on that when you talk to people that they're interested in?
Well, I mean, a lot of things do depend on – the demographic that you're talking to. And all of my speeches include the same kind of information. I don't switch according to demographic. I stay with the same things that are on my website. However, the number one issue, I have signed a contract, candidates with a contract, saying that I will not take corporate, PAC, or special interest money. If you're not human, you cannot donate to me. And I will work to dismantle Citizens United. That is a Supreme Court case that hurt us by bringing in dirty, dark money, allowing people to donate huge amounts of money secretly when humans can't do so, and unlimited amounts of money when humans can't do so. And the Supreme Court case itself said in the dissenting opinion that the Congress could limit the amounts and require disclosure just like it does humans. So why Congress hasn't acted on that, I don't know. But that's an underlying problem for every single problem that we need to solve, because as long as our elected leaders are more worried about where their next donation is going to come from and having to make their decisions based on not upsetting their donors rather than their constituency and serving the population, the country, the state, as long as we have that conflict of interest, we will not be able to solve a lot of problems. Healthcare, for example, we should have expanded Medicare, or we should have buy-in from Medicaid. We should definitely make sure that every person in this country has access to real healthcare, that they don't have to depend on GoFundMe healthcare, because that's what we're becoming, a GoFundMe healthcare system. And GoFundMe actually teaches you how to tell your story better so that people, strangers, will donate to you, which is basically Hunger Games. We can't solve that problem if we're unwilling to hold insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, and the healthcare industry in general accountable for basically charging huge amounts for profit and not delivering healthcare. We can't solve those problems if our elected leaders are more worried about their donations than serving the public.
Yeah, I've been to so many fundraisers to help people medically, and we'll raise $2,000 or $3,000 for somebody who has cancer that's costing hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to treat, medicines that are $6,000 a month. And we always do it, but that's the wrong way to do it. We need large-scale, complete medical insurance for everybody, and I think that I applaud you for having that as a central part of your campaign, because we are really the only industrial country that doesn't have some version of this. I mean, countries vary from the quality of their health care, but we're like the bottom, and we're the wealthiest country in the world, in this large country.
And we pay more than anybody else in the world for our health care for less outcomes. And everybody in this country should be able to have the same health care that you can get when you work for a large corporation. everybody should have that, because right now, if you have to work for a large corporation in order to have health care, that means that you can't change jobs because you have to decide whether or not the new job offers you the same health care. And if you get sick, you have to continue to work in order to keep the health care because you're sick. This is not about socialism. Like you said, every industrialized country has some form of health care for all. We're the only one that doesn't. We used to be the country that could. We can figure out our own system. It does not have to be government provided, although Medicare is a great example of a very efficient system that could be expanded, and Medicaid as well. But we don't have to have the government mandate it. It could be gone through nonprofit. There are lots of ways to make sure that our healthcare industry is based on health instead of profit, and that's what we have to focus on.
Well, that's the key, exactly. Based on the for-profit healthcare system seems a little silly. Listen, before we get much further, tell us a little more about, because this, you know, we got a shot at you here. I want Deidre Boone is running for U.S. Senate. Tell us a little more about your personal life, just so listeners can get. Are you married? What's the story?
I'm married. When I moved to Arizona in 98, I had been studying Islam actually for a long time because I used to try to convert Muslims to Christianity. And so I studied the religion more and more in order to get better at that agenda. And, you know, the more I studied it, the more it spoke to me. And I think that religion speaks to people in different ways. So in 98, I moved in Arizona. In 99, I met my husband actually at work. I was already Muslim. I became Muslim after I moved to Arizona. And he was actually born Muslim. He's from Iraq. But he didn't know anything about Islam, so I had to teach him. A lot of Muslims don't know anything about religion. It's just cultural.
A lot of Christians don't know anything about Christianity, right. For sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of people grow up with cultural understandings of things. I mean, we have a lot of quotes that are attributed to the Bible or Jesus that, you know, actually you can't find them. They sound good, and they're you know, maybe even in line with the teachings, but, you know, they're actually not attributed to the right place. So I've been married since 99, so I think this year is my 19th anniversary, and we don't have kids. It never happened, and we were fine with that. Fortunately for us, we're big into communication, so it's actually a discussion of a possibility that we might not have kids. We had that discussion before we got married. Uh-huh. So, you know, once you know, it wasn't happening, we were able to comfortably have that discussion. Do we want to do anything about it? You know, is this a problem? And we really set that up from the beginning, having absolute open communication within our marriage.
How about family support for your campaign?
Yeah, my family, most of my family is outside of Arizona. They're in Texas and Arkansas. They are astounded, you know, because my family, I was the first one to go to college and finish college. I was the first one definitely to go to higher education, go to law school. And I was the first one that really got into politics. So, you know, my mom, when I became a civil rights and social justice advocate, my mom was actually concerned. She, you know, called me and said, you know, this could be dangerous. You know, people in that line of work, you know, these troubled times can be targets. And I said, you know, I'm good. I take precautions, but I, you know, also believe that we have to stand up to stuff, and those who can should. But then she also told me, because she worked for the government for many years, she was one of the first law enforcement officers that was female in Arkansas, and then she became a federal marshal and then a federal investigator.
Wow.
So she, you know, told me, you understand that they're not going to go after you. They're going to go after your husband, especially if you upset the government, because, you know, he was going through immigration at the time. He came here under asylum, and then we got married. But, you know, I actually did have to go talk to my husband about that. You know, I mean, what if they decided to take it out on you and, you know, put you in a detention center and take away your green card and all of these things? And, you know, he's always been my biggest fan, always been my greatest support. And he said, well, if that's what's supposed to happen, you know, maybe there's a reason. So So we'll take that by day by day.
So and your mom was a
fan now too. He travels for business, and he's always following me on all the social media.
Oh,
he
good.
Knows what I'm doing before I can tell him.
So your husband's a lawyer?
No, actually, he's a CEO of some family businesses for his own family.
Great. Okay, but your mom was a badge and gun carrying law enforcement officer?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I grew up with guns.
Yeah.
I have respect for them. When I was young, I mean, my parents didn't even lock up the guns because we knew through threat of life from my parents that they would absolutely kill us if we touched the guns or got in the pool without their permission or without them being home.
Yes, I'm a gun owner. I'm ex-military, but I'm a Democrat, and I believe in gun control. I think this, you can't put children's lives at the bottom of the list,
You know what the biggest problem with this issue is? Is that everybody in Congress keeps saying there's nothing we can do. And I look at it and I say, well, there's always something we can do. First of all, every right can be curtailed. We even curtail, freedom of speech, and guns already have some limits. You can't buy every weapon that's ever been manufactured. We have limits on that. But more importantly, why can't we do something such as enforce the law that currently exists? If someone has lost their legal civil right to possess a gun, why are we not making sure that they're in an accurate database and that database is checked before their gun purchase? Why are we not making sure that people who are privately selling, even at gun shows, but their primary income is not from selling guns, can sell anybody a gun without checking that database? What good is the law if we're not following the law? And why is someone who's on a no-fly list, who can't fly because we're concerned about them being a threat, but they can still go buy a gun? They can't get on a plane, but they can buy a gun.
Right. Just enforce the current laws, and we certainly would have much more control over.
Well, the gun industry is a huge industry, and it pours a tremendous amount of money into lobbying and into building political support. Their problem is, of course, guns last a long time. My grandfather's revolver from World War I still works. Not a revolver, but automatic from World War I. Still works. I mean, they don't wear out very easily, so you've got to get people scared and concerned over and over again, or you can't sell the amount of guns, and particularly ammunition, you need to make a really, really, really big profit.
Well, that goes back to money in politics. Right, so our elected leaders are more concerned about where their next dollar is going to come from, whatever the group that they're trying to get money from, which could be the NRA. And also the NRA doesn't represent gun owners anymore. It represents manufacturers. So everything that they say and do is to support manufacturers, not gun owners.
That's a hard sell, and it's an important point, because NRA, American Institution, and all of that, and yet they don't represent the 4 million that they say that they have, dues-paying members. And you hear NRA members say that all the time. It is just a difficult...
But the reality is, it wasn't that long ago that the NRA backed gun regulation.
Absolutely.
It wasn't that far back that they backed people being educated on firearms. These were their two issues.
Yeah,
and
when I was young,
it's totally the other way.
I was a member of the NRA, and you're right. What I see you saying is true, is that it's moved from gun safety and hunting and all this stuff to this kind of bizarro, over-the-top cult, where maybe other people don't care enough, or maybe it's the amount of money they have. And there's been some studies of how they direct money indirectly rather than direct donation.
Yeah, the dirty money. Which, by the way, we have the outlaw dirty money petitions to get it on the ballot in Arizona that we can't have that hidden money.
Yeah, did you meet Terry Goddard yesterday?
Sorry?
Did you meet Terry Goddard yesterday?
I've met him all through the campaign.
Okay,
I've known him for years, way back when I was a civil rights and social justice advocate. But yeah, I was talking to him about this initiative before he actually announced the initiative.
Oh, good. It's a great plan. It's certainly a great step, isn't it?
Well, we can't continue to, we don't let human beings, the people who actually vote and are affected by all of the laws that go, that pass. The government has a moral responsibility to enforce law and curtail bad, to keep bad actors from acting bad, whether they're human or they're corporations. And allowing for this undisclosed money to change hands and influence our laws, when we don't allow humans that kind of freedom, just blows my mind.
But maybe we should grant corporations citizenship and let them vote. What do you think? I mean, that's the reverse of this.
Technically, that'd be a double vote.
Yeah.
Because everybody in a corporation, even though a corporation is a separate entity, everybody in it also gets to vote. All the board members, you know, the CEO, all the employees. So the corporation would get an additional vote.
Well, they buy additional votes anyway.
I totally agree with that.
Why not take the next
step?
At least
that would be transparent, right?
Talking to Deidre Abood, a candidate for U.S. Senate in Arizona. Deidre, that I know campaign strategies are, you know, some of the most well-guarded secrets, but how are you going to win this? Where are you going to go here? How are you going to do this?
The same thing that we've been doing since we started, actually getting out and talking to the people. I attended 500 events all over Arizona between April and December. Do the math. That's more than one a day.
Wow.
It was usually 1 to 6 a day. Getting out, talking to the people, sharing openly on social media where I am, what I'm doing, what I'm saying. We Facebook Live almost every speech that I give, and we put a lot of them on YouTube. I'm going to get out, talk about the issues that matter, stand for something, because that's what a leader does. They stand for something, and they're able to explain what they stand for, why they stand for it, and with a meaning. And I allow people to ask me anything, anywhere, anytime.
You said it at the beginning of this, you talked about a hunger for leadership, a hunger for
to be inspired, to see somebody that stands for something. They're
excellent.
Hungry.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
People are truly
hungry for true leadership, and especially now, if you're going to say that you want to be a U.S. senator and you can't talk about the issues that are affecting people's lives, you can't talk about the shootings, the March for Our Lives, you can't show up for Red for Ed, you can't speak out against the administration on the real bad things that sometimes they do. I get it that you don't want to talk about everything. I mean, basically, most of the stuff in the media is just chaos and stuff to make people angry. I don't need my leaders to be distracted by that, but we do need our leaders to stand up when it matters. We need them to stand up and say, you know what? It is inhumane for the United States of America, the country known throughout the world as the beacon of freedom, to separate children from their parents at the border for no other reason than to make people too scared to come to the border and ask for asylum. Leadership says that is wrong.
Well, absolutely, and you have... It's maybe one of the wrongest things that we've done lately. The rule of law is something that this administration, that it seems like both sides of the aisle, the current occupant of the White House flaunts the rule of law. The current members of the Senate flaunt the rule of law. I'm having trouble with this, that the leaders don't take, are so corrupt that they have just know the laws don't apply to them. And I don't, I'm.
Well, even Mac, Trump's lawyers are arguing that he has the power to pardon himself.
There you go.
And that laws do not apply to him. They're arguing that. And, you know, as a lawyer, you know that when you don't have the rule of law, you get into to serious problem. What other issues would you like to talk, folks? Tell us your URL for your website and Facebook, and tell folks a little bit how they can contact you and contribute to the campaign.
Everything is Deidra 2018, D-E-E-D-R-A 2018. So whether it's YouTube or Facebook or the website, everything Deidra 2018. And, you know, you can sign up for our newsletter. One of the decisions that we made early on is our newsletter is actually useful and informative. Instead of telling you life is hard, give me some money. We actually give you value, as I feel like, you know, our elected leaders should. We're completely transparent. Like I said, you know, so many issues on the website. We have the most active and fun and interesting and useful social media on all the platforms. I want to talk a little bit about the rule of law, though. The rule of law is a lot of the things we traditionally believed were the law. Now we're finding out the law actually didn't specifically say that. So a lot of things are going to end up in court, and that's a good thing because we'll either have Congress finally pass some laws or we'll have court interpret, and you would hope that that would mean that they would actually put these things, you know, solidify these points that we always assumed kept our elected leaders in check. But also one of the things that our campaign is doing is trying to empower voters to be more empowered than just whether or not they can elect or not elect people into office continuously. It's really hard to beat an incumbent. And I got in April when Flake was assumed to still be running. My opponent didn't get in until she found out that Flake wasn't running. So while I already knew what kind of battle that I was going to be joining,
right.
but the rule of law, I want voters to know that I will hold myself accountable, and I will give you more tools to hold me accountable on the things that I say and do by, one, making sure everything I say and do is public, and signing contracts on everything that I say that I'm going to do. And one of my contracts even tells you what it looks like if I don't do it, what I will do if I fail to deliver, and what you can do besides just not electing me next time, what you can do to hold me accountable legally, and that I will succumb to you holding me accountable legally. Because if the law is not going to hold our elected leaders accountable, and we are not going to hold ourselves accountable, then we have to give more tools to the public to hold us accountable.
There's a recent controversial decision by the Supreme Court just today out of a case in Colorado where
the wedding cake,
and they ruled in favor of the guy who made the wedding cake against the gay couple who had complained that that he had denied their rights. So it's a conflict between civil rights and sort of religious rights. Where do you stand on this?
She's already responded to it on her Facebook page, but go ahead.
You're on top of it.
So the wedding cake case, I'm all for. You're a private business. You are welcome to make choices on how you want to serve your clients or potential customers. You're welcome to do that. And then, you know, as customers, we're welcome to decide whether or not to give you our money. Totally for that. What this one did extra is they didn't just say, I'm not going to serve you. They didn't just say, I don't have the cake topper of two males or two females to put on the cake, therefore I can't do this. They said, I don't like gays. I don't believe in gays. My religion says gays are going to hell. I'm not going to serve you for that reason. That's the extra.
I see.
That's where this case now has created legal discrimination.
Wow.
That certainly seems what has happened. And I do understand their arguments on both sides of the case. The guy feels that his cake designing is part of his art. He shouldn't be forced to do something that's against his religion. But I think we're going to see, don't you, a more conflict between civil rights and anti-discrimination. I know from growing up in Oklahoma, the terrible situation African Americans were forced with, but not knowing where they were going to be served in a restaurant, not knowing whether they're going to can stay in this hotel, not knowing where it was safe. They had elaborate books telling them where they could go. And I would hate to see, I think it's terrible if gay Americans would no longer be able to trust when they do an ordinary thing that they're going to be treated like everybody else. I mean, I think that's kind of tragic, really.
It is tragic, and it's also scary for the larger population, because they're saying that because my religion doesn't believe in being gay, therefore I shouldn't have to serve you. And actually you don't. You just didn't have to say it was because you were a bigot. But
they probably wanted to say that, Deidre.
Yeah, apparently.
But you could make the same argument. We had this argument. I mean, how many times was the Bible used, for example, to say that women were not human,
yeah,
or that African Americans were not human?
Slavery was
The Bible was used to justify, religious interpretation was used to justify discrimination historically. And if we think that idea has died, we are mistaken, because 2016 brought it front and center that for some people, it is not just alive, but it's thriving. And it has gained a platform in the United States.
Well, one of the things the big concerns I have about Deidre Abood, U.S. Senate candidate, is that you accepted my daughter as a Facebook friend, but I am not. You won't accept me as a Facebook friend. So could you get on that?
I'm 99
get a chance
people
here,
behind.
Number two.
Mike is another person that keeps things transparent.
That's right.
Well, by the way, my Facebook is completely open. I have zero security. I have security, but zero hidden. So you don't even have to be my Facebook friend to see absolutely everything I've ever posted in my life.
Well, the fact still remains. My daughter is your friend. I'm not. We may have some.
We'll work on this.
Okay. Margaret Chase Smith, one of the things I do, one of the many things I admire about you is that you held up Margaret Chase Smith as the first woman senator. And what made you go there?
Because she showed true leadership. Not only did she become the first U.S. senator that was female, elected on her own merit, by the way. It's not the first U.S. senator who was female. She was the first one that didn't get appointed because her husband died, who was a senator, or who ran for the seat after her congressional husband died, you know? So she was the first one that had no connection to U.S. Senate and got it on her own merit. And with a grassroots campaign, which is inspiring,
uh-huh,
as a woman during that time, but also because she was the very first senator, and she was a junior senator at the time, and female.
Right.
She stood up, was the first one to stand up against McCarthyism, the
right
first one to speak out.
That's right.
And for 4 years, she spoke out and was harassed.
And she was a Republican, right?
Remember, right? I mean, it was... She stood up to it for 4 years before the rest of the Senate decided to censor McCarthy.
We're going to jump in here. We haven't got a lot of time left.
Like 1 minute?
Like 1 minute. And we do want to, we're talking to Deidre Abood in the U.S. Senate. Such a musical name. I could have some fun with that. Running for U.S. Senate, Kyrsten Sinema is her opponent. She's running for the seat left vacant by Jeff Flake, and has been a well-known face, quite frankly, in the Rhodey Valley and Sedona. She's come to many, many events here. We got a long time to go to the election. Of course, she's working up to the primary August 28th, and so that's the when you get a chance to, that's what we're working toward here. Listen, we want to remind you that you can catch this show and all our shows on VVID.org. Democratic Perspective is on VVID.org. Thanks a lot, Deidre.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.